defended the opposition viewpoint at the 15th Party Congress. In January 1928, he was expelled from the party and deported to Astrakhan, and later to Barnaul. It had not been until February 1934, one of the very last, that he had recanted and been readmitted to the party. He had been implicated in the Pyatakov trial and was arrested on January 27, 1937. Apart from the doctors, he was easily the oldest of those in dock. And even among his veteran fellow accused, his record stood out as long and legendary. The 65-year-old revolutionary had refused to testify to the NKVD for 8 months, one of the best records in the trials. He now confessed that he had been a British spy since 1924. His disavowal of Trotskyism in February 1934 had been designed to deceive the party. On his rehabilitation, he had been sent to Japan at the head of a Red Cross delegation, and this was made the occasion for him to incriminate the then Soviet ambassadors in the Far East, Yurinev and Bogomolov. He himself became a Japanese as well as a British spy. Vyshinsky got in one particular unfair smear. Rakovsky's father had been a landlord. Vyshinsky, hence I am not mistaken when I say that you are a landlord? Rakovsky, you are not mistaken. Vyshinsky, well, now. It was important for me to establish whence you received your income. Rakovsky, but it is important for me to say what this income was spent for. Vyshinsky, this is a different matter. Everyone among the old Bolsheviks knew that Rakovsky had spent everything he had on the revolutionary movement, financing the Romanian Socialist Party, which he had founded, and its paper, which he edited, and also subsidizing Russian and other revolutionaries. Now provoked enough to try to draw attention to these facts, he was instantly silenced. When Rakovsky began to refer to the opposition, Vyshinsky interrupted briskly. In your explanations today you are generally permitting yourself to use quite a number of such expressions, as if you were forgetting that you are being tried here as a member of a counter-revolutionary bandit, espionage, diversionist organization of traitors. I consider it my duty to remind you of this in my interrogation of you and ask you to keep closer to the substance of the treasonable crimes which you have committed, to speak without philosophy and other such things, which are entirely out of place here. Rakovsky finished by explaining that his surrender after 8 months had been due to getting information, during the summer of 1937, about the Japanese attack on China and the extent of Nazi and Italian intervention in Spain. This had a stunning effect on me. Rancor and ambition fell from me. He decided that his duty was to help in this struggle with the aggressor, that I would go and expose myself fully and entirely, and I told the investigator that on the following day I would begin to give complete, exhaustive testimony. This sounds, in the context of interrogation and exhaustion, a credible exposition of the Rubishov motive, more so, indeed, than the reluctant and partial confession of Bukharin, on whom Rubishov was founded. Rakovsky's evidence, adjourned over the night, had lasted until the morning of 5 March. The court then took Zelensky, a much less interesting figure. He had, however, a past in the highest party ranks, as a former, 1923-1925, Secretary of the Central Committee and Secretary of the Moscow Party Organization, who had been removed for inadequate hostility to Zinoviev and Kamenev. He had merely been transferred to be Secretary of the Party's Central Asian Bureau from 1924 to 1931, and had never lost his place on the Central Committee. In his Asian capacity, he had already been implicated as an agent of Trotsky by Ikramov and Kodzhaev. But his main role now was to explain how he had given rise to popular discontent, in the position he had held from 1931 to 1937, as chairman of the consumer cooperatives, that is, virtually the entire official distribution network. He had had unexampled opportunities for doing this. Starting with an account of his work as a Tsarist police agent in the party from 1911, he admitted complicity in Kamenev's actions in 1924, and recruitment by A.P. Smymov into the rightist organization in 1928 to 1929. After Smirnov's exposure, that is, in 1933, his contact became Andropov. Under his instructions the whole shop system was badly disrupted. Zelensky, the Reich's engineered interruptions in the supply of, and again, commodities of everyday use to the trading organizations. Thus, for instance, interruptions of this kind were engineered in the Kursk region in the first quarter of 1936, in the sugar supply. Many shops were out of sugar for 2 or 3 weeks. Similar interruptions were engineered in the Leningrad region in the Makorka supply. There were similar interruptions in the summer of 1936 in the bread trade in a number of rural districts of the Belarusian SSR situated near the frontier. To give you some idea of the character of these interruptions, I will point out the following, Out of 30,000 shops inspected by the cooperative trade sections of the Soviets and by trade inspectors, there was no salt in 3,700 shops in the first quarter of 1936. Out of 42,000 shops, 2,000 shops had no sugar on sale. In the third quarter of 1936, 1,600 shops out of 36,000 had no Makorka, so that these were not isolated cases, but rather widespread. Voyshinsky, was there a case in 1936 when Moscow was left without? Eggs through your fault, through the fault not of you personally, but of one of the active participators in this conspiratorial bloc? Zelensky, there was. Voyshinsky, do you remember when this made itself most acutely felt? Zelensky. I cannot recall the month just now, but I can mention the following fact. In 1936, 50 carloads of eggs were allowed to spoil, from wrecking motives. He had also dislocated the accounts system. Zelensky. Voyshinsky, Zelensky. Voyshinsky. Zelensky. It seems to me that the question of overcharging, short measure and short weight should be clear to everybody. It is very obvious. It consists in the following. When a man comes into a shop to make a purchase, he is overcharged, given short measure and short weight, that is, he is named a price higher than the one at which goods should be sold, or is given shorter weight than he is entitled to, or is sold goods not of the proper quality. Why is this done? To arouse discontent among the population. Prices are fixed by the trading organizations or by the salesmen in the shops very often at their own discretion, that is, without control. And so it is almost impossible to detect a man who overcharges the consumer. This matter assumed a serious and widespread character. To give some idea of the extent of this wrecking work, I may mention that of 135,000 shops that were inspected by the cooperative inspectorate, cases of overcharging and defrauding purchasers were established in 13,000 shops. The actual number was considerably larger. Another important form of wrecking, also designed to arouse the discontent of the population, was the freezing of trade by dispatching goods to the wrong districts or at the wrong times. For example, there were cases when summer goods were sent in winter and vice versa, when winter goods arrived in the shops in summer. That is, the public was offered felt boots in summer and summer shoes in winter? Yes. All this was partly due to his staff. Zelensky. I had instructions, and I pursued the aim of contaminating the apparatus with alien, hostile, anti-Soviet and insurrectionary elements. How contaminated the apparatus of the Centris I use was maybe judged from the fact that when I was in charge of it, about 15% of the staff of the Centris I use consisted of former Mensheviks, socialist revolutionaries, anarchists, Trotskyites, etc. In certain regions the number of alien elements, former members of other parties, Kolchak officers, and so on, as, for example, in the Krasnoyarsk territory, Irkutsk, and West Siberia, was considerably higher. He then got into a curious altercation with Voyshinsky. Voyshinsky. Zelensky, Voyshinsky. Zelensky. Voyshinsky. Zelensky, Voyshinsky. Colon, but how did matters stand with butter? We don't sell butter in the rural districts. I am not asking you what you sell. You are above all selling the main thing, your country. I am speaking about what measures were taken by your organization to disrupt trade and deprive the population of prime necessities. Apart from sugar and salt, do you know anything concerning butter? I told you that the cooperatives do not sell butter in the rural districts. I am asking you, have you any knowledge of criminal operations with regard to supplying the population with butter, particularly cheap grades of butter, or not? Operations which were effected on the orders of your bloc of Rights and Trotskyites, are they known to you or not? Yes, they are. In what did they consist? Zelensky. Voyshinsky, Zelensky, Voyshinsky. Zelensky. The President. Voyshinsky. Zelensky, Voyshinsky. Zelensky, Voyshinsky. Zelensky, Voyshinsky, Zelensky, Voyshinsky. Zelensky. They consisted in the following. In making butter, all the produce purchasing organizations use the international standards fixing quality of butter. That is not the point. That is the point. No. What do you mean? This was done. Accused Zelensky. No crosstalk, and keep to the point. And was the butter which was issued for sale always of good quality, or did you try to spoil its quality too? Yes. Were there cases when members of your organization connected with the butter business threw glass into the butter? There were cases when glass was thrown into the butter. Were there cases when your accomplices, fellow participants in the criminal plot against the Soviet power and the Soviet people, threw nails into the butter? There were. For what purpose? To make it tastier? That is clear. Well, that is organized wrecking and diverse of activities. Do you admit that you are guilty of this?
I do. In addition to his vaguely unsatisfactory and undignified style of reply, Zelensky balked at a major question.
Wyshynsky, did you take part in the wrecking, diversive, terrorist and espionage work of this bloc?
Zelensky, I did take part in wrecking and diversive work.
Wyshynsky, about espionage work you so far say nothing?
Zelensky, no reply.
Wyshynsky, do you answer for all the criminal activities of the bloc?
Zelensky, I do.
This last a weak ploy by Wyshynsky. Zelensky did, however, admit contact with A.V. Alexander, the British Labour and Cooperative leader, with whom he had discussed the possibilities of a rightist government in Russia. Akhramov's examination, which we have already covered, came next. When he had finished, first Besenov was again questioned. He gave evidence of connections with socialist revolutionary émigrés, with Trotsky, and with the Nazis. Bukharin and Duck. And now, at last, the main subject of the trial was brought to questioning. Wyshynsky started his duel with Bukharin. After his arrest, Bukharin had been confronted with Radek, who, however, had qualified his evidence against him, saying that Bukharin had objected to the degree of Trotsky's commitment to the Germans, and refusing to confirm some of the more vicious charges. In The Great Terror, I wrote that Bukharin had not been tortured. This was based on general report, though also on a definite statement by Mikoyan after Stalin's death. From recent Soviet articles, it does not appear to be true. Perhaps Frenovsky's order beating permitted, with which the investigation of the case started, was not applied in its full vigor. But we are now told that, though Bukharin held out for 3 months, threats to his wife and infant son, combined with methods of physical influence, wore him down, and he now wrote to Stalin, "Dear friend, if it is necessary for the party, I will go to trial as you wish." At interrogations on 1 and June 1937, he confessed that the Ryutin platform expressed his own views and that many others shared them, including Rykov and Tomsky, but also Aglanov, Rudzutak, Anipov, Lamov, Unschlicht, and others. It is reported that he now agreed, in a long talk with Yuzhov and Voroshilov, as representatives of the Politburo to confess to all the charges, including that of having planned to assassinate Lenin. But when, 2 days later, his confession, amended and corrected by Stalin personally, had been given to him to sign, he was so shocked that he withdrew his whole confession. The examination started all over again, with a double team of interrogators. He finally agreed once more to testify, but refused to say that he had planned Lenin's death. One of the charges brought against him in court, that of espionage, was not raised at all during his interrogation. It was doubtless felt that he was unlikely to agree to it, so it now was sprung on him for the first time at the trial. He had evidently decided on his tactics after considering the earlier cases. His confession, like Rykov's, avoided admitting direct complicity in any of the worst overt acts, but accepted general responsibility. Anything less would have doubtless led to his omission from the trial and the execution of his wife. As it was, Wyshynsky threatened to stop his evidence. Before Wyshynsky could speak, Bukharin asked the court to allow him to present his case freely and to dwell on the ideological stand of the bloc. Wyshynsky at once asked for the request to be denied, as limiting the legal rights of the prosecution. Bukharin then said that he confirmed his evidence at the preliminary inquiry. He then made his carefully phrased acceptance of guilt. "I plead guilty to being one of the outstanding leaders of this bloc of rights and Trotskyites. Consequently, I plead guilty to what directly follows from this, the sum total of crimes committed by this counter-revolutionary organization, irrespective of whether or not I knew of, whether or not I took a direct part in, any particular act." He had, he admitted, planned the forcible overthrow of the Soviet power, and with the help of a war which prognostically was in prospect, relied on the help of foreign states to which territorial concessions would be made. Wyshynsky, and also by means of weakening the defensive power? Bukharin, "You see, this question was not discussed, at least not in my presence. As to wrecking, the orientation on wrecking was adopted. But again, when a concrete question was put." Wyshynsky. Bukharin. "As you see from the trial, the circumstances were concrete enough. Did you and Kozayev discuss the fact that too little wrecking was being done, and being done badly? About accelerating wrecking there was no talk." Bukharin then admitted that the bloc stood for the assassination of the leadership. Wyshynsky immediately asked whether the Kirov murder had been committed on the instructions of the bloc. Bukharin. Wyshynsky. Bukharin. Wyshynsky. Bukharin. Wyshynsky. The President. Wyshynsky. Rykov. Wyshynsky.
Rickiff. I do not know. I ask you, was this assassination committed with the knowledge and on the instructions of the Bloc of Rights and Trotskyites? And I repeat that I do not know, citizen prosecutor. You did not know about this specifically in relation to the assassination of S.M. Kirov? Not specifically, but, permit me to question the accused Rickiff. You may. Accused Rickov, what do you know about the assassination of Sergei Maranovich Kirov? I know nothing about the participation of the rights or the right part of the Bloc in the assassination of Kirov. In general, were you aware of the preparations for terrorist acts, for the assassination of members of the party and the government? As one of the leaders of the right part of this Bloc, I took part in the organization of a number of terrorist groups and in preparations for terrorist acts. As I have said in my testimony, I do not know of a single decision of the Right Center, through which I was related with the Bloc of Rights. Wyshynski. Rickiff. Wyshynski. Rickiff. And Trotskyites, about the actual commission of assassinations. About the actual commission. So. Do you know that one of the aims of the Bloc of Rights and Trotskyites was to organize and commit terrorist acts against leaders of the party and government? I said more than that, I said that I personally organized terrorist groups. But you're asking me whether I knew of such aims through some third person. I am asking whether the Bloc of Rights and Trotskyites had any relation to the assassination of Comrade Kirov. I have no information regarding the relation of the rights or the right part of the Bloc to this assassination, and therefore I am convinced to this day that the assassination of Kirov was carried out by the Trotskyites without the knowledge of the rights. Of course, I might not have known about it. Tilda. Wyshynski, baffled, then called on Yagoda, who said that both Rickiff and Bukharin were lying. Rickiff had been present, with Yanukidze, at the meeting which had discussed the question. However, Yagoda now started to drop peculiar hints on his own. Wyshynski. Yagoda, Wyshynski, Yagoda, Wyshynski, Yagoda. Wyshynski. Yagoda. After this, did you personally take any measures to effect the assassination of Sergei Maranovich Kirov? I personally? Yes, as a member of the Bloc. I gave instructions. To whom? To Zaporozhes in Leningrad. That is not quite how it was. And then you gave instructions not to place obstacles in the way of the murder of Sergei Maranovich Kirov? Yes, I did. It was not like that. Wyshynski, in a somewhat different form? Yagoda, it was not like that, but it is not important. Wyshynski hastily dropped the matter and started to question Bukharin about the allegation that he had intended to kill Lenin. Bukharin admitted that there had been a plan in 1918 to arrest Lenin, but when Wyshynski asserted that this must mean to kill him, he pointed out that Dzerzhinsky had actually been arrested by socialist revolutionaries at the time, and not killed. Conceding that Stalin and Sverdlov, too, were to have been arrested, he added that under no circumstances were the three to have been killed. Wyshynski postponed the question until witnesses were called. Bukharin was then allowed to start to speak at length. Ulrich told him to stick to his criminal anti-Soviet activities, but after 10 or 15 minutes he was still expounding a theory of the way rightism inevitably led to the restoration of capitalism. Ulrich interrupted to say he must not make his defense plea now. Bukharin countered, "This is not my defense, it is my self-accusation. I have not said a single word in my defense. Degree nor, strictly speaking, had he." And he now went on to admit that his program would have meant a lapse into bourgeois democratic freedom, which, Wyshynski pointed out, and he accepted, meant in effect outright rabid fascism. Wyshynski turned to espionage. Wyshynski. Then why was it so easy for you to join a Bloc which was engaged in espionage work? Bukharin, concerning espionage work I know absolutely nothing. Wyshynski, what do you mean, you don't know? Bukharin, just that. Wyshynski, and what was the Bloc engaged in? Bukharin, two people testified here about espionage, Sharangovich and Ivanov, that is to say two agents provocateurs. Here Bukharin was cleverly turning the trial's tactics against its originators. Ivanov had, on his own evidence, been a Tsarist agent. Provocateur in the revolutionary movement, for a Bolshevik audience, no lower form of life, no more untrustworthy character, could exist. His evidence was automatically worthless. But at the same time, Bukharin was surely suggesting that he was still following the same trade, under different orders. Wyshynski now scored a point by turning to Rickov, who again admitted knowing that espionage was being conducted by the Belarusian National Fascists, and that in my opinion, Bukharin also knew. Bukharin simply retorted that he had not known. His connections with the Austrian police, which Wyshynski raised, consisted of my imprisonment in an Austrian fortress. Wyshynski, accused Sharangovich, you were a Polish spy, Although you have been in prison? Sharangovich, yes, although I have been in prison. Bukharin, I have been in a Swedish prison, twice in a Russian. 112. Prison, and in a German prison. Bukharin went on to elaborate the negotiations for and the structure of the alleged bloc, from his conversation with Kamenev in 1928 on, with special attention to the Ryutin platform. Again Ulrich intervened. So far you are still beating about the bush, you are saying nothing about your crimes. Bukharin spoke of the planned coup of 1935 by Yanukidze and Peterson, of which nothing had ever come. And, continuing his evidence at the next session, on the morning of 7 March, he developed this theme to include the Tukhachevsky group. Vyshinsky here objected to his use of the term palace coup. He admitted also sending insurrectionary organizers to the provinces, but denied all knowledge of their connection with White Guard and German fascist circles. Again there was a long tussle as Vyshinsky tried to get him to admit and Rykov to confirm that he knew of this. But this time, Rykov rallied and supported Bukharin's point. Rykov went on to deny knowing that Kara Khan was a spy. And on the whole issue of negotiation with Germany, Bukharin admitted that Trotsky had spoken of ceding the Ukraine, but that he himself did not consider Trotsky's instructions as binding on me. On Kara Khan's alleged negotiations. Wyshynsky, Bukharin. Wyshynsky, Bukharin. Wyshynsky, Bukharin. Wyshynsky. Bukharin, Wyshynsky, Bukharin. Wyshynsky, Bukharin. Did you endorse these negotiations? Or disavow? I did not disavow them, consequently I endorse them. I ask you, did you endorse them, or not? I repeat, citizen prosecutor, since I did not disavow them, I consequently endorse them. Consequently you endorse them? If I did not disavow them, consequently I endorse them. That's what I am asking you, that is to say, you endorse them? So then consequently is the same as that is to say. What do you mean, that is to say? That is to say, I endorse them. But you say that you learned of this post factum. Yes, the one does not contradict the other in the slightest. Vyshinsky again started to hammer at the espionage theme, raising with Rykov the matter of the Belorussians. And now, for half an hour, came one of the most striking exchanges in the whole of the public trials. Wyshynsky, Rykov, Wyshynsky, Rykov, Wyshynsky. Rykov, Wyshynsky. Isn't this an espionage connection? No. What kind of connection is it? There was an espionage connection there, too. But was there an espionage connection maintained by a part of your organization with the Poles on your instructions? Of course. Espionage? Rykov, Wyshynsky, Rykov, Wyshynsky, Rykov, Wyshynsky, Rykov, Wyshynsky, Rykov, Wyshynsky, Rykov, Wyshynsky. Rykov. Wyshynsky, Bukharin, Wyshynsky, Bukharin, Wyshynsky. Bukharin, Wyshynsky, Bukharin, Wyshynsky, Bukharin. Wyshynsky. Of course. Bukharin included? Of course. Were you and Bukharin connected? Absolutely. So you were spies? No reply. And the organizers of espionage? I am in no way better than a spy. You organized espionage, so you were spies. It may be said, yes. It may be said, spies. I am asking, did you organize connections with the Polish intelligence service and the respective spy circles? Do you plead guilty to espionage? If it is a question of organization, then in this case, of course, I plead guilty. Accused Bukharin, do you plead guilty to espionage? I do not. After what Rykov says, after what Sharangovich says? I do not plead guilty. When the Organization of the Rights was set up in Belorussia, you were at the head of it, do you admit that? I have told you. I am asking you, do you admit it or not? I took no interest in Belorussian affairs. Did you take an interest in espionage affairs? No. And who did take an interest? Bukharin, I received no information with regard to activities of this kind. Wyshynsky, accused Rykov, was Bukharin receiving any information with regard to activities of this kind? Rykov, never spoke to him about it. After going over the ground again, Vyshynsky only got Rykov back to his old line. Rykov. Wyshynsky. Sharangovich, Wyshynsky. Sharangovich, Wyshynsky. Sharangovich, Wyshynsky. Sharangovich, Wyshynsky. I mean to say that we did not personally direct this development, however, it is not a question of direct leadership but of general leadership. We absolutely and definitely bear responsibility for this. There is no point in making a pious face, accused Bukharin. Better admit what exists. And what exists is the following, You had a group of accomplices, fellow conspirators in Belarusia, headed by Golodin, Chervyakov, and Sharangovich. Is that right, Sharangovich? It is. And on Bukharin's and Rykov's instructions, and under their leadership, you established connections with the Polish intelligence service and with the Polish general staff? Is that right, Sharangovich? Absolutely right. Under your leadership also with regard to the espionage connections. Is that right, Sharangovich? Absolutely right. Consequently, who was the organizer of the espionage in which you engaged? Rykov, Bukharin. Hence, they were spies. Sharangovich, Wyshynski, Sharangovich, Wyshynski. Rykov, Wyshynski, Rykov, Wyshynski, Rykov. Wyshynski. Rykov. Wyshynski. Rykov. Quite right. Just as I myself. Be seated. To Rykov, accused Rykov, did Golodin tell you in 1932 that all more or less important appointments of people to responsible posts in Belarusia were first coordinated with the Polish intelligence service? Yes. Did Bukharin know of this? I cannot say. You do not know. You do not want to betray your pal? What I mean to say is that in those cases when I know that he is not telling the truth, I am exposing him, but in those cases when I do not know, I cannot and shall not do it. I am asking you with regard to the fact that the Poles were giving their consent to the various appointments to official posts in Belarusia. Was this known to your leading center? I knew of it. As for Bukharin, I never spoke to him about it. I also knew that Chervyakov and Golodin maintained connections, not only with me, but with Bukharin and Tomsky as well. Whether they spoke of this to Bukharin I cannot say, because I was not present at those conversations. Do you think that it would have been natural for Golodin to speak to Bukharin about this question? Or did they have to keep it a secret from Bukharin? I think that, naturally, he spoke to Bukharin. But what they talked about I do not know. Wyshynski, I shall ask you now by way of making a supposition, do you suppose that Bukharin knew of this? Rykov, this circumstance. I prefer to speak only of what I knew, and as to what I do not know, my position in the courtroom is not such as to allow me to advance. 115. Suppositions. On his conversations with Bukharin, Rykov went on to say, I do not recall any conversations dealing especially with this espionage work. I do not exclude the possibility that there were such conversations, but I do not remember. Equals. After a long exchange with Rykov about the meaning of some of his preliminary evidence, which Rykov pointed out was meant not as fact but as supposition, Wyshynski turned to Bukharin, who immediately remarked, I was not asked a single word about this during the preliminary investigation, and you, citizen prosecutor, did not question me for 3 months, not a single word. At this Wyshynski lost his temper and shouted that Bukharin was not going to instruct him about how to conduct an investigation. He then turned on Rykov again, but got no further. He concluded weakly, permit me to consider it established that Rykov and Bukharin knew the substance of the treasonable connection which included espionage. Is that correct, Rykov? Rykov, that is, espionage followed. Bukharin, so it appears that I knew something from which something followed. Ulrich turned the accused back to the theme of the proposed coup d'état. Following that, Bukharin denied having told Kodzhaev about an agreement with Germany, and after further argument about this Wyshynski again lost his composure, and Bukharin was able to remark, there is nothing for you to gesticulate about. Ulrich called him to order, and Wyshynski launched on a harangue, I will be compelled to cut the interrogation short because you are apparently following definite tactics and do not want to tell the truth, hiding behind a flood of words, pettifogging. Making digressions into the sphere of politics, of philosophy, theory and so forth. Bukharin replied calmly, I am answering your questions, and went on to deny having told Kodzhaev about connections with British spies. Wyshynski had remarked, during his burst of rage, that according to all the material of the investigation you are obviously a spy of an intelligence service. Bukharin now took him up on this point. Bukharin, during the year I spent in prison I was not once asked about it. Wyshynski, we are asking you here in an open proletarian court, we are asking you here in this court before the whole world. Bukharin, but you did not ask me this before. Wyshynski, I am asking you again, on the basis of the testimony which was here given against you, do you choose to admit before the Soviet court by what intelligence service you were enlisted, the British, German or Japanese? Bukharin, none. Wyshynski, I have no more questions to put to Bukharin. The court adjourned on that note. The prosecutor had been defeated. When the session resumed, Bukharin listed his contacts with emigre Mensheviks and socialist revolutionaries, and the concessions to be made to Germany. He again went out of his way to deny espionage, and say that the military conspirators had spoken to Tomsky of opening the front in case of war, but he had disapproved. Wyshynsky, and did you talk to Karakhan about opening the front?
Bukharin, Karakhan said that the Germans were demanding a military alliance with Germany.
Wyshynsky, and are the gates closed to an ally?
Bukharin, Karakhan gave me an answer to this question.
Wyshynsky, that the gates are closed to an ally?
Bukharin, no.
Wyshynsky, that means to open the gates?
Bukharin, pardon me, there was no alliance yet.
Wyshynsky, but there were expectations, plans?
Bukharin, well, just now the Soviet Union has an alliance with France.
120. But that does not mean that it opens the Soviet frontiers. Wyshynsky now went on to the crime with which Bukharin alone of those on trial was charged, the plan to assassinate Lenin in 1918. The prosecution produced three prominent left communists of that period, Yakovleva, Mantsev, and Osinsky, the last, originally Prince Obolensky, still a candidate member of the Central Committee elected in 1934. At the time, Varvara Yakovleva, a candidate member of the small 1917 Central Committee, had been the more prominent, and with Bukharin, Pyatakov, and V.M. Smirnov had resigned when the decision to accept the Peace of Brest-Litovsk had been taken. She now fully confirmed Wyshynsky's story. Bukharin had no difficulty in showing that the alleged illegal activities of early 1918 were not illegal at all, and that in fact the leftists, with the Trotskyites then roughly aligned with them, held a majority and hoped to enforce their views through ordinary party channels. After this majority had been lost, he admitted, conversations had taken place with a view to arresting Lenin and forming a new government. Bukharin had indeed thought of arresting Lenin for 24 hours with a view to making it easier to change the government, and had given the whole story as long ago as 1924. There had also been conversations with the left socialist revolutionaries, who had dropped out of the Soviet government on the peace issue. What Bukharin denied was that there had been any sort of plan to kill Lenin or complicity with the socialist revolutionaries. He went on to point out that many who had been left communists at the time, including Kuibyshev and Menzinsky, were not for that reason now regarded as enemies. He was ruled out of order. A series of points, including the fact that he had been wounded by a bomb thrown by the left socialist revolutionaries at a time when he was now charged with conspiring with them, were similarly ruled on. Mantsev's evidence followed the same lines, and Osinsky gave a rather more restricted account, omitting certain points against Bukharin. Bukharin denied the evidence about the assassination plan, and twice hinted strongly at the reason for the witness's attitude. Wyshynsky, consequently, you assert that Mantsev's testimony in this part and the testimony of witness Yakovleva are false?
Bukharin, yes, I do.
Wyshynsky, how do you explain the fact that they are not telling the truth?
Bukharin, you had better ask them about it.
And later on. Wyshynsky, you must somehow explain the fact that three of your former accomplices are speaking against you.
Bukharin, you see, I have neither sufficient material nor the psychological requisites to clear up this question.
Wyshynsky, you cannot explain.
Bukharin, not that I cannot, I simply refuse to explain.
Getting no further with this, Wyshynsky called two new witnesses, the old socialist revolutionaries Boris Komkov and Vladimir Karelin. They were in neat blue suits, their faces gray and corpse-like. They had been in prison for years. An even more important socialist revolutionary, Maria Spiridonova, was implicated with her comrades. She had been arrested on February 8, 1937, with 12 other former left socialist revolutionaries, in Ufa, where they were living in exile. They were first accused of terrorist plots against the Bashkir communist leadership. But then the whole of that leadership was itself arrested, and charges of plotting against Stalin and Voroshilov were substituted. On December 25, 1937 they were sentenced on these and other charges by the military collegium to various terms of imprisonment, in Spiridonova's case, 25 years, the charges now including setting up a center to unite all opposition parties, preparing peasant uprisings, and so on. After a hunger strike, she was held in isolation, finally in OR1. But she seems to have refused to cooperate in the present trial. Komkov had apparently been released during the 1920s, but was back in prison no later than 1933. Komkov now said that he understood from others that Bukharin had been informed of socialist revolutionary intentions, but he could not himself testify to this directly. He denied that there was any joint decision by the left socialist revolutionaries and left communists. Wyshynsky again became flustered at the firm attitude of the old revolutionist, and when Bukharin tried to ask a question, he burst out with, "I request the accused Bukharin not to interfere in my interrogation. I am restraining myself enough, and I request my opponent to restrain himself."
Komkov again denied the point. Vyshinsky abandoned the witness without putting the point about Lenin's assassination. Karelin was more amenable, and confirmed the plan to kill Lenin. He also brought in an entirely separate action, the genuine attempted assassination of Lenin on August 30, 1918 by the freelance right socialist revolutionary Fanny Kaplan. This, he said, had been insisted on by Bukharin, and his insistence transmitted through the left socialist revolutionaries. Osinsky, called on to confirm this, said he had heard some vague gossip about Kaplan's shot being inspired by the anti-government stand of the lefts, but I can say nothing of Bukharin personally in such a connection. Bukharin denied the whole thing. Vyshinsky, Osinsky spoke on the subject. Bukharin, Osinsky said that he could say nothing about me. Vyshinsky then tackled Bukharin directly, in an attempt to make him concede that the atmosphere in the party had been so heated in 1918 that assassination would have been rational. Bukharin denied this, and again denied the evidence. Vyshinsky, but why do both former left communists and left socialist revolutionaries say so, everybody? Bukharin, no, not everybody, of two left socialist revolutionaries, only one said it. With a final categorical denial, Bukharin's examination was over. In the indictment, the cases of Yakovleva, Mantsev, Osinsky, Komkov, and Karelin are among those mentioned as being the subject of separate proceedings. The death dates of both Komkov and Karelin are now given as 1938. We can presume that they were in fact executed for their alleged part in the plan to assassinate Lenin, and similarly with Osinsky, sentenced in secret by the military collegium and shot on September 1, 1938. Yakovleva, whose evidence had been the most satisfactory, survived until 1941. The Doctor Poisoners. On the morning of 8th of March, the most horrible and obscure of all the crimes alleged against the Bloc were reached. Over the next 2 days, the system of alleged medical murders carried out directly under Yagoda's orders was the main subject of examination. The plan to charge the opposition with these medical murders seems to have been adopted soon after Yazhov took over the NKVD. Of the doctors concerned, as we shall see, Pletnev was already embroiled in the NKVD's plans by December 1936. Pletnev's hope as late as 5 March, 1937, that the medical world would protect him presumably refers to the date of his arrest. Krichkov, Gorky's secretary, also involved, was denounced, with other writers associated with Yagoda, on 17 May, but his date of arrest is now given as 5 October, with the arrest dates of others directly involved in the poison plots as Dr. Levin, 2 December, Maximov Dikovsky, Kuibyshev's secretary, 11 December, and Dr. Kozakov, 16 December, which may indicate that a final decision to go ahead with these charges was not made until a fairly late stage. There were four of these alleged murders. First, in May 1934, Menzinsky, Yagoda's predecessor as head of the OGPU, had been killed by his favorite doctor, Kozakov, under instructions from Levin. Then, in the same month, Gorky's son Maxim Peshkov had been killed by Levin and Pletnev. Next came Kuibyshev, killed by Levin and Pletnev, and finally Gorky himself, killed by Levin and Pletnev. The 68-year-old Dr. Levin gave the first evidence. He, together with Yagoda, was the organizer of the medical killings. He had served in the Kremlin since 1920 on the staff of the medical services of the NKVD. Levin had worked for Dzerzhinsky, Menzinsky, and Yagoda, which can certainly be taken as showing him not merely in the medical confidence of the OGPU, NKVD, as he said himself, he enjoyed a definite recognition and confidence in me on the part of the head of the OGPU. He also had a feeling that I would perish with Yagoda. In fact, he may be regarded as to some degree another of Yagoda's NKVD circle, all of whom were to go to the execution cellars. Levin remarks, too, that he has told the truth from the first day I entered prison. If that is taken at its face value, it is so different from the attitudes of other non-party accused that it indicates a high state of discipline vis-à-vis the NKVD. Bukharin, in a brief cross-questioning of Dr. Levin, asked if he had not been a counter-revolutionary saboteur in 1918 after the Bolshevik seizure of power, as if this were a generally known fact. This question seems quite irrelevant, and indeed, if anything, damaging to the accused in general, but if we seek a special implication, it must be that Levin had been especially susceptible to NKVD blackmail and threats about his past. Levin gave model evidence on the layout of the alleged crimes. As developed in his and the other testimony, it amounted, 1, to getting Kozakov, Menzinsky's pet quack, to kill him by an overdose of his patent method, so that Yagoda could inherit the leadership of the OGPU, 2, to killing Peshkov by having Gorky's secretary, Krichkov, get him drunk and leave him passed out on a garden bench in the cold, though it was May, and loosing Levin, Vinogradov, and Pletnev on him when he caught a chill, and, 3, to arranging bonfires to affect Gorky's weak lungs, trademark, and then taking him to see his granddaughters when they had colds, which he caught, thus also falling into the hands of Levin and Pletnev. Kuibyshev, 4, had simply been given bad treatment for his heart, but had finally died for lack of medical attention, which, in the circumstances, it might have been thought, he was lucky to avoid. Levin explained how Yagoda had recruited him in a highly plausible way, which brought a sigh even from the trained audience. Levin, he said, have in mind that you cannot help obeying me, you cannot get away from me. Once I place confidence in you with regard to this thing, once confidence is placed in you with regard to this matter, you must appreciate it and you must carry this out. You cannot tell anybody about it. Nobody will believe you. They will believe not you, but me. Have no doubts about this, but go ahead and do it. You think it over, how you could do it, whose services you could enlist for this. I will call you in a few days. He reiterated that my refusal to carry this out would spell ruin for me and my family. I figured that I had no other way out, that I had to submit to him. Again, if you look at it retrospectively, if you look back at 1932 from today, when you consider how all-powerful Yagoda appeared to me, a non-party person, then, of 143. Of course, it was very difficult to evade his threats, his orders. Kazakov was called to corroborate Levin's story about Menzinsky. Unlike Levin and Pletnev, Kazakov was not a doctor of reputation, though evidently honest in his eccentricities. He employed, as Bulanov was to remark, very intricate drugs that were not only unknown to medicine, but not very well known to Kazakov himself. Menzinsky had sworn by Kazakov's lysates method. In Dr. Levin's evidence, there is a sardonic description of much talk of a miraculous medicine produced by a Professor Schwartzman, who had earlier made a good impression on Menzinsky, ending in disappointment. Then there was another sensation, there was a lot of publicity about Ignaty Nikolaevich Kazakov, and he, Menzinsky, turned to Kazakov. He was one of the small group of important people at that time who were under the impression that they were being helped by him a great deal. There had even been a special meeting of the Council of People's Commissars to discuss Kazakov's method, one of several examples of the leadership's tendency to swallow ideas rejected by specialists of the science in question. Kazakov confirmed Levin's evidence, and said he had been taken to see Yagoda personally, submitting out of fear on hearing the remark, "If you make any attempt to disobey me, I shall find quick means of exterminating you." Yagoda was now called. He looked very different from his old self. His hair seemed whiter, and his former jauntiness had gone. But he still showed a certain bitter energy. His evidence was extraordinary, and must be significant, even though he was to withdraw it later in the day. Wyshynsky. Yagoda, Wyshynsky, Yagoda, Wyshynsky, Yagoda, Wyshynsky. Yagoda, Wyshynsky, Yagoda. Wyshynsky, Yagoda. Accused Yagoda, did you instruct Levin to tell Kazakov that he would be asked to come and have a talk with you? The first time I saw this man was here. So you gave no such instructions to Levin? I gave instructions to Levin to talk it over. With whom? With Kazakov, but I did not receive him personally. I am not asking you whether you received him or not, I am asking you whether you instructed Levin to talk it over with Kazakov. I gave no instructions to talk to Kazakov. You just said here that you gave Levin such instructions. I gave Levin instructions to bring about the death of Alexei Maximovich Gorky and Kuibyshev, and that's all. And how about Menzinsky? I did not bring about the death of either Menzinsky or Max Peshkov. Vyshynsky called Kryuchkov, who confirmed his role in killing Peshkov. On Yagoda's orders. He then turned on Yagoda again and read from his evidence at the preliminary examination confessing to the Menzinsky and Peshkov murders. Wyshynsky, did you depose this, accused Yagoda? Yagoda, I said that I did, but it is not true. Wyshynsky, Yagoda, Wyshynsky. Yagoda, Wyshynsky, Yagoda, Wyshynsky, Yagoda, Wyshynsky, Yagoda, Wyshynsky, Yagoda, Wyshynsky. Yagoda, Wyshynsky, Yagoda, Wyshynsky. Yagoda. Wyshynsky, Yagoda. Shinsky. Why did you make this deposition if it is not true? I don't know why. Be seated. I summoned Kazakov and confirmed my orders. He did his work. Menzinsky died. Did you depose this, accused Yagoda? I did. Hence, you met Kazakov? No. Why did you make a false deposition? Permit me not to answer this question. So you deny that you organized the murder of Menzinsky? I do. Did you admit it in this deposition? Yes. When the prosecutor of the union interrogated you, what did you answer to this question about your part in the murder of Menzinski?
I confirmed it also then.
You confirmed it.
Why did you confirm it?
Permit me not to answer this question.
Then answer my last question, did you file any protest or complain with regard to the preliminary investigation?
None.
Are you filing any now?
No.
Taking up the Peshkov murder, Vyshinsky went on.
So everything that Krichkov says, Yagoda, Vyshinsky.
Yagoda.
Vyshinsky, Yagoda, Vyshinsky, Yagoda, Vyshinsky, Yagoda, Vyshinsky.
Yagoda, Vyshinsky, Yagoda, Vyshinsky.
It is all lies. You gave him no such instructions regarding Maxim Peshkov.
I have stated, citizen prosecutor, that with regard to Maxim Peshkov I gave no instructions.
I see no sense in his murder.
So Levin is lying?
He is lying.
Kazakov is lying?
Yes, lying.
Krichkov?
Is lying.
You gave Krichkov no instructions regarding the death of Maxim Peshkov.
At the preliminary investigation you, I lied.
And now?
I am telling the truth.
Why did you lie at the preliminary investigation?
Yagoda, told you.
Permit me not to reply to this question.
This last was spoken with such concentrated venom and fury, an American observer notes that the whole audience gasped with dismay and terror. When Ulrich intervened, Yagoda turned on him and said, in a phrase not included in the official report, you can drive me, but not too far.
I'll say what I want to say, but, do not drive me too far.
Again everyone was shaken. If Stalin was present in the hidden room above the tribunal, where during this trial a trick of the light at one point made him clearly visible, even he might for a moment have wondered whether his whole plan was not about to be wrecked.
Yagoda, more than any of the others, had reason to resent the trial.
He, more than anyone, had performed irreplaceable services for Stalin. His arrest had so affected him that he could not sleep or eat, and Yazhov had feared for his sanity.
Slutsky, the insinuating head of the NKVD Foreign Department, had been sent to talk to him.
Yagoda complained about the ruin of the police organization he had built up over 15 years, and one day remarked that God must after all exist. From Stalin he deserved only gratitude, but from God the fate which had actually overtaken him. But his present demonic outburst was left in the air.
Vyshinsky turned back to Levin.
Levin now developed the Kuibyshev and Gorky murders, and Yagoda confirmed them. Towards the end of the morning, when Levin was going into the detail of Gorky's death, Yagoda suddenly said, may I put a question to Levin? Though such cross-examination by defendants had been usual practice in the previous days of the trial, Ulrich hastily replied, after Levin finished his testimony.
Yagoda, making it clear that his question was immediately relevant, insisted.
This concerns Maxim Gorky's death.
Ulrich, evidently fearing the worst, cut him off, when the accused Levin finishes, then by all means.
He shortly ordered a 30-minute adjournment.
After this Vyshinsky said, I think the accused Yagoda wanted to put questions to the accused Levin.
The accused Yagoda, you may put questions.
President.
Yagoda, I ask Levin to answer in what year the Kremlin Medical Commission attached him, Levin, to me as my doctor, and to whom else he was attached.
When this question had been answered, with no reference whatever to Gorky's death or to any of the other crimes, Yagoda said he had no more questions.
It will be seen that what he wanted to say before the adjournment cannot have been the same as what he actually asked after.
Levin was then questioned by his defending lawyer, Broad.
Two points were made.
First, Levin said of the directing organization behind the murders, I knew nothing about it. I learned about it only at the trial itself. He then reiterated what was evidently, in one way or another, a powerful motive for obeying those capable of carrying out such measures. What frightened me most was his threat to destroy my family. And my family is a good, working, Soviet family. The court had earlier announced an expert commission of five doctors. The morning session of 8th of March concluded with the following exchange.
The President, have the expert witnesses any questions to ask the accused Levin?
Sharashevsky and the expert witnesses have no questions to ask, Vinogradov, everything is quite clear.
The evening session of 8th of March saw the evidence in chief of Bulanov, Yagoda's personal assistant, and of Yagoda himself.
Bulanov, a veteran NKVD officer, he had been in charge of the expulsion of Trotsky from the country in January 1929, testified to the special version of the planned coup involving Yanukitsa, Yagoda, and the seizure of the Kremlin, and developed its links with the Tukhachevsky group and with Karakhan's German negotiations. He went on to say that Yagoda had protected Oglanov and Ivan Smirnov in their interrogations and had ordered no search to be made when Zinoviev and Kamenev were arrested. He implicated all the old NKVD chiefs in the plot,
and described how Yagoda had ordered Zaporozhets to facilitate Kirov's assassination, and how Zaporozhets had released Nikolaev on his first attempt and later killed Borisov. It must have seemed curious that Yagoda, arranging through Zaporozhets to let Nikolaev in to kill Kirov, had not thought to do something similar in Moscow by the agency of Paukar and Volovich, in charge of Stalin's personal security, and both now implicated as plotters. A new crime was now developed: Yagoda's attempt to kill Yazhov after the latter had taken over the NKVD in September 1936. Bulanov and another officer, Savo Lenin, whose case was sent for separate trial, had sprayed a mercury solution 6 or 7 times in Yazhov's office, and on the rugs and curtains, together with some other, unidentified poison. Bulanov went on to describe a special poison laboratory that Yagoda had it fixed up under his personal supervision. Yagoda was, Bulanov said, exceptionally interested in poisons. This laboratory is believed to have really existed. Yagoda had been a pharmacist by profession before the revolution. Given the characters and the motivations, this is one crime which appeared to be possibly genuine. Yazhov's health, it was alleged, was considerably impaired. But a recent Soviet account quotes Yazhov at his own interrogation a year later as saying with a smile that obviously people could not get into his office so easily, and that he had made the whole thing up to look better in Stalin's eyes. On the medical poisonings, Bulanov remarked, plausibly enough, as far as I know, Yagoda drew Levin into, enlisted him in the affair, and in cases of poisoning generally, by taking advantage of some compromising material he had against him. Bulanov asserted that Kazakov had indeed visited Yagoda, in spite of the latter's denials. Kazakov again confirmed this. Vyshinsky then put it once more to Yagoda. Vyshinsky, after this testimony, which establishes your part in the poisoning, do you continue to deny it? Yagoda, no, I confirm my part in it. And then? Vyshinsky accused Bulanov, and was the killing of Maxim Peshkov also Yagoda's work? Bulanov, of course. Vyshinsky accused Yagoda, what do you say to that? Yagoda, I admit my part in the illness of Peshkov. I request the court to 159. Hear this whole question in camera. Yagoda is described as having looked cornered and desperate during the earlier session, but he now appeared crushed, and gave his evidence in a toneless voice. Vyshinsky next tried to implicate Rykov in Gorky's murder, on the grounds that Yanukidze had once allegedly said to him that an end should be put to Gorky's political activity. Rykov answered that doubtless Yanukidze meant murder by this, but that he himself had not so understood it at the time. He then put a question to Bulanov, who had spoken about Rykov's archives being looked after by Yagoda: what were the contents? Bulanov said that he did not know, but Rykov had clearly established that there was an alleged mass of documentary evidence which no one had produced in court. Yagoda's own evidence in chief followed. A recent Soviet account has it that Yazhov promised Yagoda his life if he incriminated Bukharin, registered, but if so, Yagoda's confidence in Yazhov's word cannot have been high. His voice was now utterly weary and so faint that it could barely be heard. He stumbled through a written statement, reading it as though for the first time. He confirmed his long connection with the rightist plotters from 1928 on. In the early days, he had supplied Rykov and Bukharin with tendentious material from the NKVD secret files, for use in their anti-party struggle. It was due to his activities in the NKVD that the Rights, and the Bloc of Rights and Trotskyites, had not been uncovered and liquidated until 1937-1938. He had appointed conspirators to all the leading posts in the secret police: Molchanov, on Tomsky's express instructions, Prokofiev, Mironov, Shannon, Paukar, Gay, and others. He had joined in Yanukidze's plot to seize the Kremlin, and it was on Yanukidze's orders that he had arranged for Zaporozhets's collaboration in the Kirov assassination. But when cross-examination started, he still showed a remnant of resistance. Bulanov's evidence about trying to kill Yazhov, he said, had been wrong in detail, and correct only in essence. Vyshinsky then taxed him with espionage. Yagoda replied, no, I do not admit being guilty of this activity. He admitted shielding spies in the NKVD. Vyshinsky, I consider that since you shielded this espionage activity, you helped them, assisted them. Yagoda, no, I do not admit being guilty of that. Had I been a spy, I assure you that dozens of states would have been compelled 162. to disband their intelligence services. This sensible remark did not deter the Soviet leaders from the practice of nominating the heads of their secret police as imperialist employees. Rykov again raised the question of his archives. Yagoda said, I had no archives of Rykov's. Bulanov then reaffirmed his evidence about these, and when Yagoda challenged him to mention any of their contents, he said he could not. Yagoda finally commented contemptuously, but tellingly, in any case, had the archives really existed, in comparison with the other crimes, the Rykov archives are a trifle. Later he refused to admit that he had protected Mensheviks. Wyshynsky, but in any case you shielded this, even very insignificant role of the Mensheviks?
Yagoda, I shall not be able to give you an answer to this question.
Wyshynsky, allow me to quote to Yagoda his testimony in Volume 2, here, question, you are shown a document from the materials of the People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs, containing a report on the Menshevik Center abroad and on its active work in the USSR. Do you recall this fact?
Yagoda, yes, I know, only I shall not be able to give you an answer to this here.
When it came to the medical numbers, he was still not entirely satisfactory. First he admitted his part in causing Max's, Peshkov's, sickness, but when Wyshynsky pressed him to plead guilty to causing, as you express it, Peshkov's sickness, he simply answered that he would give all his explanations in camera. Wyshynsky asked twice more, with the same result. Finally.
Wyshynsky, do you plead guilty or do you not?
164. Yagoda, permit me not to answer this question. The only distinction between what Yagoda had admitted and Wyshynsky's formulation was that the former spoke simply of his part in causing and the latter of guilt for Peshkov's death. Yagoda seems to have been implying either that he had caused the fatal illness in an unintentional way or, more likely, that he did not accept the major guilt. Whether either version is true is another matter. Yagoda went on to admit to killing Menzinsky and to reluctantly becoming involved in the murder of Gorky, at Yanukidze's insistence. When Wyshynsky went through his crimes at the end of the day, asking in turn whether Yagoda was guilty in the cases of Kirov, Kuibyshev, Menzinsky, and Gorky, he did not refer to Peshkov, a minor victory for the accused. Levin's defense counsel, Broad, then cross-examined.
Broad, allow me to ask you, what methods did you employ to secure Levin's consent to commit these terrorist acts?
Yagoda, in any case not such as he described here.
Broad, you yourself went into detail about this at the preliminary investigation. Do you confirm this part of your testimony?
Yagoda, it is exaggerated, but that doesn't matter.
Wyshynsky now attempted to involve Bukharin in the Gorky murder. Bukharin defended himself effectively. The evidence, even at its face value, was simply that Tomsky had once said to him in conversation that the Trotskyites were opposed to Gorky and had some idea of a hostile act against him. A hostile act could be anything from a newspaper article up, and in any case such a conversation, as he pointed out, could not possibly prove that he, Bukharin, had murdered the writer. Krichkov, Gorky's secretary, followed. He had left Peshkov lying in the snow in March or April, without result, and finally managed to leave him out to catch a chill in May. Levin and A. Ivanogradov had managed to persuade other doctors and nurses to give the patient a fatal dose of laxative. When Gorky, in turn, had been given a cold, Pletnev and Levin had insisted on overdoses of digitalis. The most tragic of all the figures in the great trials was examined on the morning of 9 March. Professor Dmitry Pletnev, a 66-year-old heart specialist, had long enjoyed a reputation as Russia's leading doctor, the pride of the profession. Now, for the first time, if we accept the petty crook Arnold, a figure from outside the whole machinery of state, the whole political controversy, stood for trial, and confessed. He, above all, represented the silent non-party masses whose sufferings in the purge were otherwise hidden from sight. When Yazhov had decided that a confession from Levin alone would clearly not be impressive enough, he had turned his attention to Gorky's other main physician. But Pletnev had been before the revolution a member of the Liberal Constitutional Democratic Cadet Party. There was no question of appealing to him on the basis of communist morality. But equally, he had avoided politics since the revolution, and no political blackmail against him was possible. Yazhov's solution was nasty even by Yazhov standards. A preliminary decision on the story of medical murders must have been taken soon after he succeeded to Yagoda's post. An NKVD provocateur, a young woman usually employed to compromise foreigners, was sent as a patient to Pletnev. After a couple of consultations, she accused him of having assaulted her 2 years previously. By December 1936, she was coming to his house, annoying his daughter and housekeeper, and he complained to the police. They affected to take up his complaint, but instead went into hers, and claimed to believe it. Pletnev appealed to his medical and personal connections to help him. He was treating Orjonikidze and others, as late as 5 March, the official account tells us, he was still expecting that such help would be forthcoming. But the contrary was true. On 8 June, Pravda, by a very rare exception to its policy of not dealing with individual crimes,
published under the sensational headline "Professor, Rapist, Sadist and Account" in three half columns. Pletnev had, it told, thrown himself upon the woman patient B on July 17, 1934, and bitten her severely on the breast. This had done her a permanent injury which Pletnev